Sure.
If he wants to do that?
Yeah, if you want.
I don't know.
I'm going to call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this lovely, what day is it today? Lovely day in February with the sun shining. And I'm going to ask first our friends from DCBS to come and talk to us about what's going on in the marketplace. I intend to take no more than 30 minutes on this. We asked them to hold it to 20 minutes and leave 10 minutes for questions.
Great.
Interesting. Go for it, Mr. Allen.
Chair Green, like members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm joined today by Laura Calley, who administers our Division of Financial Regulation and is the state's insurance commissioner. We're going to tag team this a little bit today. Laura's going to talk initially about a little bit of how we got here, because it didn't begin a week ago Wednesday. Briefly talk about that. I'll talk about what happened at the point that we became aware of a problem and what led up to the negotiations of a resolution of this. Before I turn it over to Laura, you do have a couple of documents that I apologize you've not seen in OLIS. They've really just become public actually with this hearing. And the bottom line is that we have entered into a consent order with MOTA that allows them to remain in the insurance market, and we'll talk about some of the circumstances of that order. But first, let me turn it over to Laura to talk a little bit about how we got here.
Thank you. And for the record, my name is Laura Calley, and as Pat said, I'm the administrator of the Division of Financial Regulation and the insurance commissioner. Chair Green, like members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. So as Pat said, this didn't just begin a week and a half ago, and so there's a little bit more context, I think, that we should provide to the story. If we all remember back to last fall, I think it was October 1st was the date that CMS made an announcement about its payments on the federal risk corridor payments, and MOTA, among other insurers, had been expecting to receive payments from that program. And the key piece about that announcement is that CMS announced that it would be paying 12.6% of what it owed for 2014. And for MOTA in particular, that is a significant item on their balance sheet. And so that was a significant event for them. Following that announcement, for MOTA and really for all of the insurance companies in our market, we had to look at the combination of what had happened thus far in 2015, what the impact of the risk corridor news would have on their financials, and what their projections would be for 2016 to determine whether or not they could enter open enrollment and we could allow them to continue to enroll customers and take on new business. And I think it's important to emphasize that that's something that we looked at for every single insurance company in our state. It was critical and important for us to make sure that every company could enter open enrollment and have the capacity to serve its customers. So at that time, we did that analysis for MOTA and for others, and MOTA entered open enrollment, and it began taking new customers and renewing its existing customers. If we fast forward to January of this year, and I think it's important to give you a little bit of context about financial reporting and when we actually receive information about what's happened in different points of the time, year-end financial statements are due to us at the end of February. And so at this point, we're still awaiting final information from all of the insurance companies about what happened in 2015. But in late January, we did hear that MOTA in late Q4, really very much at the latter end of that period of time, they had a significant deterioration in their financial condition. And it was more than MOTA or we had expected to occur in that time. And that really was the news and the piece of information that set us into the course of action that you've seen unfold over the last week and a half. And so I think I'll pass it back to Pat to take it from there.
I'll pick up the story there and just spend another minute on our becoming aware of this information. This actually occurred a couple hours short of exactly 2 weeks ago today that we received a call from Alaska regulators. And I want to spend just a minute about the nature of how that happened, because there's been some discussion about that. Alaska regulators asked a very specific Alaska question. about premium and claims in Alaska. And it's worth taking just a minute to talk about the differences between Alaska's market and our market. It's much smaller than our market. It's a small fraction of the total of MOTA's business. But there are two features that are important to understand about what coverage in Alaska looks like. MOTA is one of only two carriers in the Alaska market, as opposed to one of 11 in this market. Also, under the Affordable Care Act, Native Americans, Native Alaskans have a somewhat different circumstance in terms of their ability to sign up for insurance. They don't need to worry about open enrollment. And so they're able to come and go with coverage, which creates a very significant dynamic in how that market works. It's not a big factor in Oregon, but it's obviously a huge factor in Alaska. And so Alaska was monitoring a different sort of risk and a different sort of business with respect to Alaska than we were.
Don't get fire insurance so your house is burning. Huh?
Something potentially like that, yes. And so states do regulation in partnership with each other. That's part of how the system is designed to work when you have an insurance company that operates across state lines. Alaska asked this question that we would not expect to typically ask. They looked at the information and became immediately aware that it had implications for the overall company as a whole and made us immediately aware of that, which led us to move in about 2 days later and implement our order of immediate supervision, which I think has been documented well, but in short, is sort of a regulatory way of telling a company, just stop. Stop doing anything. Stop selling policies. Stop renewing policies. Stop making significant business decisions. Just stop, so that we can get in there and assess what the circumstances really are, and work on a plan to get them out of supervision. There are a number of paths that can take. I think it's fair to say, both in our public comments as well as the company's public comments, that we began that period with the assumption that the resolution was MOTA was going to leave the individual insurance market, and we were really talking about how. MOTA had, I think, an intent to want to find another carrier to take over that business. We knew that that the worst case of their getting out of that line of business was to open what's called a special enrollment period, where we would basically reopen open enrollment for folks who had policies through MOTA, and that meant that everyone would be able to get coverage. That worst-case scenario, truly from our perspective, was a worst-case scenario. It would leave people with questions about whether they had access to the same network of providers, the ability to see their doctor, those kinds of questions. It would leave open questions related to if they had already spent money toward deductibles or out-of-pocket maximums, how those would be treated. There were a lot of negative implications of that. And were we to head down that path, it would be in a context of MOTA health plans overall condition, and that would have implications for Medicare business, Medicare Advantage, Medigap policies. It would have implications for small groups, large groups, public groups. There were significant implications all up and down its lines of business. And so a couple of things became clear in the first half of the week. One was that it was going to be unlikely MOTA would be able to do a transaction along the lines that were its preference, and certainly not in the length of time that we talked about. We talked about wanting to resolve this in a short period of time, and that meant days, not weeks. It also became clear that anything that involved a direct unwinding of that business, basically around MOTA, had serious downsides that we needed to take into consideration before we moved forward. And that led us about halfway through this process to examine what would it take for MOTA to be able to actually make good on its commitments to provide insurance through the expiration of those policies, largely year-end, but whenever they were. How much capital would be necessary to be able to assure the public, as we are today, that those MOTA policies are good and can be relied on to provide coverage? And that gets us to the consent order that we agreed to actually late in the afternoon on Saturday. And I'd like to turn back to Laura to talk about the terms of the consent order.
Thanks, Pat. So Pat started to lead off with how could we devise a plan with MOTA that would allow us to go out and assure the public that they could keep their policies in good conscience and be sure that their claims would be paid. So one of the key elements of this, and I'll talk about each of them in a little bit more detail, but one of the key elements is that MOTA is agreeing to to raise a significant amount of additional capital. And so here in the press release, we've said over $170 million. And in the consent order, it's actually a bit more specific than that. It's $179 million. And that amount is really intended to be sufficient to cover their financial projections through the policies that they have on their books today. Also includes a margin for potential adverse events, things that might actually cause this experience to be even worse than they predict. It includes margin to make sure that if there are some errors in those projections, even on top of things just kind of going, not going their way, that there's enough of a cushion here that we feel confident that we can get to the end of these policy periods and the company will still be able to meet its regulatory standards. And so that was really important to us in terms of being able to go out to the public and say, you not only can keep your policy, but you should feel comfortable that your claims will be paid and you'll be able to continue to see your doctor. That was really critical to us in getting to this resolution. There are a couple of other key features in the consent order that I want to talk about, and then I'll come back to address a little bit about the structure of the order that I think would be helpful. So first and foremost, the order does require MOTA to fulfill its obligations on its current policies through the end of this year, and in particular the individual policyholders. And that's true for both Oregon and Alaska, where, as Pat mentioned, they're one of only two carriers, and so it really has a pretty critical importance there. I talked about needing to raise a significant amount of additional capital. The consent order that you have in front of you lays out that aggregate amount of $179 million, but it also makes reference to what we call a financial plan of action or a risk-based capital plan that the company has filed with us that walks through in great detail a number of different transactions that it's going to enter into to raise that capital. And there, it's very intentionally that plan of action is a separate document that's filed with us under our RBC statute. I think it's ORS 731752. And it allows, or it requires that plan to be held confidential. It's important for that, the specific elements of what assets or other transactions might occur, the amounts and the dates, to remain confidential so that we can assure that the company has the ability to go out and execute those transactions. If you tell someone that they have to sell a car by Friday for $5,000 and you make that public, you make it very, very difficult for that person to actually realize that amount of the transaction. And so that's the kind of situation that we're in here, and it's really important, first and foremost, to the policyholders of MOTA that they be able to execute on this plan. So the consent order lays out kind of the broad terms of that. And then the details are in that other plan. But there's some other pieces that are included in the consent order that I think we should touch on as well. As MOTA's state of domicile, basically its home state regulator, we have certain specific authorities and responsibilities. And so the supervision order is one example of that. We are responsible for the financial oversight of the company and to make sure that they're solvent and that they can support all of their obligations. And that's Oregon obligations as well as obligations in states, in other states that they write. So the other states where they do business, such as Alaska, have some tools available to them. They can decide whether a company can actually be licensed to write business in their state, but they can't come in and issue an order of supervision or take a company into receivership if they need to. That all falls on the state of domicile. And so we are in a place where for MOTA or any other company, if they were to run into significant financial trouble, we can exercise those tools. But Alaska, because it's not the home state for MOTA, doesn't have quite that level of authority. And so to make sure that their policyholders are protected, they've agreed with MOTA to establish a $15 million deposit for the benefit of Alaska policyholders to make sure that their claims are paid. The other piece that I would mention is that we've retained some authority to make sure that the company is reporting to us on a regular basis about anything that may be material to its financial health. And so it's going to be providing more regular reporting, at least monthly, to us about its financial projections and cash flow, and basically give us an up-to-date understanding of where they are financially. And they're also going to be reporting to us about their efforts to manage costs. And I would add to that that we also have approval authority over any changes to executive compensation or any bonuses to executives. So those are some of the broad strokes that are in the consent order. I think I'll pause there and see if Pat has anything he wants to add.
Yeah, I'd just like to make a couple of concluding points, and then I think we'd be happy to answer questions that you have. First, what we have tried to do here, I think, is balance the disruption to consumers that would occur in trying to roll Moda out of this business with providing adequate capital to backstop risk so that we can tell, as we are Oregonians, that they can rely on these policies. I think the other point I would make is that when we went into Moda and put them under supervision on January 27th, I was pretty consistent in talking to people about the fact that we needed to resolve this quickly for the benefit of Oregonians' peace of mind, but also for the to preserve the value of the company. And we talked about quickly being in terms of days and not weeks, and I really do, with a bit of pride, want to point to the fact that that occurred on January 27th, and we're here on February 8th being able to talk about a resolution of that. And I have to mention in that context that that's due to a group of people across DCBS, not just involved in insurance regulation, but involved in taking calls from consumers and people who ordinarily talk about workers' comp issues pitching in to help, and probably 100 people or better all across the agency who pitched into this, a core of about 20 people who honestly spent 14-hour days pretty continuously from January 27th to February 8th to resolve this. And this feels like a piece of work that I am confident we can go to Oregonians and say is the right outcome for this, and that I'm very proud of our team for helping to deliver. And so with that, we'd be happy to answer questions you might have.
I'll take the first question, which is the most obvious one. Are you pretty comfortable that you're going to raise $179 million?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr.
That's
Chair.
That's the kind of answer you like.
So I just need a little clarification on managing costs. So you made the comment earlier about what they expected to be paid under Medicaid and what they got paid, and that difference, so what they were counting up. So that obviously was not the only thing that created a situation where their costs have exceeded what their income was. So you talked about now there's something in place that's going to ensure they manage their costs. I guess I'm trying to understand, so what's in place that they're going to do something different than they did that got us here?
I'll take it and then see if Laura wants to jump in. More than managing costs, what we're really talking about is the adequacy of their premiums to cover their claims. And this is all well-documented information, but clearly in 2014, their premiums were not high enough to support their claims. And far from that situation having improved in 2015, based on what happened at the very end of 2015, it appears to have deteriorated. They, as you know, have received a substantial rate increase in 2016, and that would lead you to believe that that circumstance should improve. But the point of the $179 million is to say, well, what if it didn't improve? What if actually the number that we worked from was, what? Let's say it doesn't improve. Let's say it was actually even worse than 2016. And what if something else happens that is unanticipated, that is negative, and add that to an even worse loss in 2016? And so while managing costs is an important piece of this, really the adequacy of the capital to back them, to help them weather unanticipated poor outcomes, is really the key feature of the plan.
And that federal amount was supposed to be something like $180 million, wasn't it?
Yes, that's correct. That's roughly the total amount over the over
basically,
the 3 years.
Basically, that's what you're asking me to get.
Right.
Kind of guy?
If I could just expand on that a little bit. We've been asked the question, well, didn't the federal government's decision to pay that differently really cause this? I would say it's more accurate to say that was one of a number of circumstances that were supposed to be in place to allow them to weather a bad break, whether it's a bad quarter or whatever the circumstances were. In a Modus case, they had any number of breaks that could have cut for them or against them that tended to cut against them. And what happened by the time they had this bad quarter in 2015 is all the things along the way that were supposed to help buffer them from that had pretty well, you know, gone the wrong way or had disappeared. And so that's how I would more accurately describe that risk quarter receivable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for all your incredibly hard work and everyone involved over the last couple weeks. I'm still trying to understand where the $179 million comes from.
Sure.
How does that get raised? I don't quite understand that. I must have missed something. And also, you know, what can you say about the other insurers in the marketplace? Are others experience losses relative to their size that are alarming at all?
Why don't I take the capital question and you can talk to the market. The capital comes largely, and I'll come back to that, from selling the risk corridor receivable at a discounted amount without wanting to get specifically into how much we think that is. It comes from selling other assets that are in the corporate structure. And again, I don't want to sort of characterize specifically what assets for not wanting to undermine those deals, but our risk plan or our capital plan does in fact outline exactly which assets. It does involve some amount of capital notes coming into the company. That's basically money that they borrow that they don't need to repay, at least not ahead of policyholders, but that's
those
very small.
Those would be small. Investors.
Right. Essentially, yeah. Okay. That's a very small piece of the overall transaction, and it also has some element of transactions that are between other parts of the holding company, but that, again, is a very small piece of this. Let me talk about what it's not, because what it's not, I think, is what people are afraid of. Is this just accounting maneuvers and borrowing a bunch of money to prop up the company, and are we just kind of kicking the can down the road? And so what this transaction really is not that. It's disposing of assets like the risk corridor payment in a way that brings new money into the company that doesn't need to be repaid, that recapitalizes it at a level more than sufficient, we believe, to help them get through the year. Is that at all helpful? Mm-hmm. Then let me turn to Commissioner Callie to talk about the market overall.
Sure. Chair Greenlake, Representative Kinigeyer. So I actually would add just one piece, too, to what Pat already said, which is that some of these transactions are actually going to occur quickly, and mm-hmm. you should expect to see them reflected in their year-end financial statements to some degree. And that's just the nature of the way statutory insurance accounting works, is there are certain events, and this is not, I think to be clear, this is not specific to MOTA. This is something that really is just in terms of how certain capital events can be reflected in year-end financial statements. And so you should expect to see some of that actually show up in the 2015 year-end financials. So I think that will start to become a little bit clearer when those are submitted to us at the end of February. So your other question had to do with what about other companies? You know, are there others that we need to be worried about? And I started out by talking about our evaluation of the market prior to open enrollment. And I'm going to go back there for a second in terms of our financial oversight really is over the entire market, and largely most of the insurance companies that write health insurance in Oregon are based in Oregon. So that also means that we are their state of domicile for almost all of them. So that gives us the tools and the access to information that we really the best access to that information from a regulatory standpoint, so that we are constantly monitoring based on analysis of their financial statements. If we see problems, we can require companies to report to us more frequently. We can conduct on-site exams. We do them as a matter of statute and as a matter of course of business, but we can call them on a more periodic basis if we think there's an issue. So we're always monitoring all of the insurance companies that are writing to make sure that they're meeting our financial standards. And when they're not, when it looks like something is not going right, we take action. We work with the company to get their capital up to a level that can support their business. And I think that the supervision order that we issued about almost 2 weeks ago now is an example of when there's a situation when we need to take action and make sure that the public is aware, we do it swiftly.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Greenlake. A few questions for you. Do you have a sense of what open enrollment will do to MOTA membership at this point?
Yeah, the Chair Greenlake, Representative Buehler, open enrollment, as you know, is closed now, and we don't have final reconciled numbers, and we don't have what we call effectuated numbers, the numbers that have paid their first premium. But MOTA, both in the marketplace and outside the marketplace, it appears to have acquired about 60,000 customers, split more or less halfway between the two. That represents a substantial decrease from their enrollment last year. But I would suggest smaller than I would have expected given their price increase. That leads us to learn something that we kind of were wondering about in this marketplace of how sticky is it with respect to prices. And it strikes me that it appears to be somewhat less sticky than I would have expected.
Weren't they something like $140,000 before? Do I remember that?
Chair Greenlick, I think back in 2014, and I don't have the specific numbers on me, I think it was closer to maybe 90 or 95,000. I can
both,
follow up, but I don't think it was quite over, quite at that magnitude.
I'm sorry, Representative.
Thank you. Just to follow up to that, and you've taken in consideration that decrease in enrollment in your financial projections, I assume?
Okay. Yeah,
that's correct.
Did you want to ask one more?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I have a series, but I don't
want
to.
Well, go ahead. We've got a little time.
Explain to me if there is any financial liability for the state of Oregon, or for that matter, the citizens of Oregon, for MOTA having its home state domicile in Oregon. Is there any specific financial liability that we could be undertaking with this situation?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, no. Okay. Not in the private insurance realm.
Okay.
Their relationship with the CCOs?
Somewhat different circumstance that I'm not well positioned to be able to speak to compared to the health authority. But if the question is, if a private insurance company in the individual small group marketplace goes under and can't pay claims, is the state on the hook for that money? The answer to that is no.
Can follow up? So why specifically are we allocating $15 million to Alaska to cover potential liabilities there? Why is it a special earmark?
Sure, Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, as Commissioner Calley outlined. As the domiciled carrier for MOTA or any other company, we can take over the whole darn thing and dispose of the assets and basically deal with it however we need to deal with it to potentially restructure or liquidate the business. Alaska doesn't have that authority. They can only stop them from doing business in the state, but they have no way to dispose of assets, and this gives them basically a small asset to offset against that.
Got it. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to repeat the question that Representative Kenny Geyer asked. And are there any other carriers in our market that you're worried about?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair knows. So I apologize in advance for being intentionally vague, but I think I need to reassure you that we are looking constantly and consistently at the health of all of our insurers. I can't speak specifically to the financial condition of an individual insurer. I can speak to what's in the public documents and the filings that they provide us. And I think that we will have better information to share about how 2015 shook out in full for our entire market when we have all of the financial statements in about a month. But I think maybe I can answer your question in a slightly different way. I know that's not fully satisfying, but I think when we look around at the 930 financials, we are seeing that insurance companies continue to lose money, in particular on their individual book of business. And we saw that pretty much across the market. And I remember at the end of last session, I think Pat and I were here in front of this committee and along with the Senate committee to talk about rate increases, which was a very difficult set of decisions, but it was a very important set of decisions that we felt was necessary to make in light of what we were seeing already in terms of the financial performance in 2015. And so I guess what I would say is, based on what we've seen with another quarter of data, I think we feel reassured that those were the right decisions to make.
It just in simpler terms, I would say this is a marketplace that has not quite sorted itself out yet. And as a result, we're keeping a close eye on all carriers in this market because they're all subject to those issues that need to be resolved. And when we need to take swift action, I think through this we've demonstrated that we're willing to do that.
Thank you, Chair.
I'm sorry,
thank you, Chair Greenlick. Is there any precedence for DCBS to intervene in such a consent order in the past in the healthcare market?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Greenlick. Representative Buehler, we got to ask that question a lot over the last few days, and one of the answers was sort of incredibly obvious, but we'd all sort of forgotten, which is Health Republic went into supervision about 120 days ago as part of its decision to withdraw from the market. The timing made that a somewhat more orderly transaction, but the regulatory steps are identical. Prior to that, I believe the last time a company was put under supervision was 2010. So it's not regular, but it's also not unprecedented.
But certainly the scale of this is much different than Health Republic. Is there anything of similar scale in the past?
Not in my history with the agency.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your hard work on this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You don't get paid time and a half for the weekend. We do appreciate it. I appreciate you being here to talk to us.
Thank you.
I'll close the informational hearing on DCBS. And Oda, you have a document in front of you that's hot off the press. Okay. Not either. I'll give you one. We also see no one out. We're going to carry that one over.
Which one? This one?
I guess I will announce it. In case you were here to hear something about House Bill 4060, we are not opening a work session on 4060 today.
462,
I'm sorry. 4062. And we'll try and figure out where we are now.
This one's ready.
Do we have a quorum? Yeah.
Yes, we do.
Okay. Let's open up a work session on House Bill 4105. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4105 had a public hearing on the 3rd of February. It is back before us today. This requires a pharmacy or pharmacist that dispenses a biological product to report certain information electronically or to prescribing practitioners, provides exceptions, declares an emergency effective on passage. We adopted the Dash 1 amendment on February 3rd. It aligns the definition of biological product with the federal definition. It establishes January 2nd, 2022, as a sunset date on the notification requirement contained in the bill. We do have the documentation, Mr. Chair, on the Dash 1 amendment. There's no revenue and there's a minimal fiscal impact.
Do we have a motion on the amendment?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
We already put that amendment.
We adopted the amendment on the 3rd, yes, Mr. Chair.
I have an amendment on the bill, a motion on the bill.
Ready?
I'm ready.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 4105 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 4105 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this bill?
A comment. I've had a hard time getting my hands around this bill or my head around it or whatever it is you're supposed to get around it. And been on both sides of it. I think the notification is probably the better process. So I think that's where I'm going to land, but we'll see.
It's a better process. You're going to be a yes, right?
I think so.
All right. Any other discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative
Kinnegar?
Aye.
Representative
Whiteley? Aye. Representative Whitener? Excuse.
Vice Chair
Higgs? Excuse. He'll probably be back, and we'll get him to vote on it when he comes back.
Vice Chair Nost?
Yes.
And Chair Greenlee?
Yes. Motion carries. Representative Nost, will you carry this on the floor, please?
Yes, I will.
All right. Moving right along.
Chicago.
Rich.
These are public
hearings.
Yeah.
Okay.
San Francisco
employment games.
Those are
we need to get Davis on here.
He's in revenue. I can run down and get him.
But unless.
Kinds of advantages that people have there.
It's up to you where you want
4.7% in San Francisco down to 2.5% this year. 4.8% in the rest of California. So where it was before.
Stand at ease for a moment. I'm not sure where we are.
Except there, where it went down to 2.5.
it for the blue man.
No, the guy got taken care of.
Let's open the work session on House Bill 4030 for the purpose of adopting a couple of amendments. We don't have the paperwork, so we'll adopt the amendments and move it over to Thursday with the intention of...
Wednesday.
I mean Wednesday with the intention of moving it to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4030 had a public hearing on the 1st of February. It requires the Oregon Health Authority to amend the Medicaid state plan to implement programs to increase medical assistance reimbursement paid to public providers of emergency medical services, specifies requirements of the program, declares an emergency effective on passage. That's the original bill. Mr. Chair, what you have is the Dash 1 amendments, which were presented at the February 1st meeting, which modifies the original bill, directs OHA to convene a work group to develop recommendations for emergency medical services reimbursement to be in alignment with the Oregon's integrated and coordinated healthcare delivery system. It specifies the membership of what the recommendations are to include. It also directs that the report be presented to the 2017 Legislative Assembly. It does delete the emergency clause. And we have the Dash 2 amendment that I just got this morning, and I think Representative knows.
You want to talk about
it? You want me to explain it?
Please.
If you want.
Sure, I can try. The Dash 2 amendment basically just allows for the possibility for the private sector entity to be considered for this reimbursement that we're exploring. And if CMS will allow it, they would be able to get it. And if CMS won't permit it, it doesn't frustrate the overall purpose of the bill.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
Does it have anything to do with the voluntary?
The Dash 2?
Yeah, that's what it is.
The voluntary is the same as the private? Because I remember hearing about the voluntary and the private as if it was two different things.
It does.
Okay.
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is inclusive. I think it sort of what we talked about last time about trying to raise all boats, and I think it's very commendable that people have worked together to pull this together. I want to thank Representative Noss for adding a little elbow. And I think, as far as I know, people are in agreement now. And it's too bad this isn't ready to proceed, but we'll get ready to go.
I think we are as soon as we get our act together.
No.
I see a lot of familiar faces in the audience, but for those that are not familiar, this time is a particularly trying time because if we're going to move anything, we have to move any House bill, we have to move it today or Wednesday. So we're carefully trying to keep track of what's going on so things don't slip through our fingers, which means we look a little more incompetent than usual. But that's me.
Really?
Not you.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're a team.
Where are we, guys?
Okay. I'm going to make a motion.
Please.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 4030 dated February 1st, 2016.
Representative Noss moves we add the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 4030 dated 2-1-16. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? So moved.
I'd like to make another motion if I can, Mr. Chair.
You indeed may.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that the committee adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 4030 dated February 5th, 2016.
Representative Noss moves we adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 4030 dated 2-5-16. Is there any discussion on that motion? Did you get your question answered, you think?
Yes.
Okay. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved. I'll close the work session on House Bill 4030 and carry it over to Wednesday.
And Rep. Davis is here for his 41. Representative Davis is here.
Oh, okay, good. And that number is
4107.
Mm-hmm. Open a public hearing on House Bill 4107. I invite Representative Davis to join us. We have several CCO bills, and we're negotiating now to decide whether to deal with them in this session or to put them all together and deal with them in the interim or There's some combination of those things. So we won't be opening a work session on any of the three CCL bills today that we have.
Every bill.
Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm State Representative John Davis from House District 26. The fight in 26th!
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Put that on.
Holy cow.
You're out of order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Way out.
I was awakened.
And it is a real pleasure to be here this afternoon. I believe this is my first opportunity to testify in front of the House Committee on Health Care in my entire legislative career. I often tell my wife, who is a pediatric ICU nurse, that as an attorney, I'm the doctor in the family, and she promptly tells me I'm the wrong type of doctor. So keep that in mind, perhaps, as I'm testifying about this bill. So I am testifying about House Bill 4107. I do want to note for the record that amendments that are posted on OLIS are for a different bill. There's a mix-up in the numbers. They're actually for 4017. So yeah. I flip those over to the other bill, which is also on the docket for today. That'd be appreciated. Okay. So ignore those amendments. What we're looking at is the rather uncontroversial area of coordinated care organizations and global payments. This is as you know, and I know you heard bills, or at least one bill on Friday regarding this issue. This is an area of immense complexity, dealing with actuarial rates and just incredibly complex patient data. What House Bill 4107 speaks to is contracts, and that's one reason I became interested. As a business lawyer dealing with contracts on a daily basis, the retroactivity portion of new CCO contracts that has caused significant consternation in this space. This bill would do a few things. Starting in Section 1-4, it continues to require at least 60 days advance notice from OHA, Oregon Health Authority, before there could be a proposed amendment to a CCO contract. An amendment to a contract could only apply retroactively. That's really what this bill is about, is retroactive changes to CCO contracts. Those changes could only apply retroactively if they did not result in a claim for overpayment, unless the claim for overpayment comes from an assessment from CMMS that an overpayment has been made and a demand from the federal government for that overpayment.
Just to make the point, all of the CCOs currently are working on five-year contracts.
Yes.
So the question is, what are the circumstances in which that five-year contract can be changed?
That's correct. And in particular, this is focused on amendments that are applied retroactively to budgets within those contracts and the annual payments made in each of those contracts. As each of you know, and just speaking broadly, the success of healthcare transformation and switching from an ATM style payment for healthcare services to a global payment for healthcare services depends on a commitment to patients and to Oregonians that quality healthcare will be available each year, year in and year out. And for those who are members of CCOs, the care will be made available to them. An instability that can be created, and that really has been created the last few years by changes applied retroactively to payments within contracts, I think undermines that commitment that we need to be making. There'll be certainly more specifics about this bill and about the reasons for it from those who testify after me, but I simply wanted to make that point that we should first be very concerned as a state when an agency is making retroactive changes, and particularly concerned when it deals with the health care of Oregonians and the need to provide stability in an environment when we're trying to switch from that fee-for-services, ATM-style model to a global payment model that looks at the overall health care of the patients. Thank you very much.
Any questions as a representative? Thank you very much. We have, I think, one witness. Is that right?
Two, Mr. Chair.
Would you call the witnesses, please?
Heather Rayburn and Courtney Johnston.
And if you'll excuse me, I'll have to get back to Revenue Committee.
Good work.
Mm. Sorry.
What was it, fight in 26? Fight in 25th?
Chair Greenlich, Vice Chair Noce, members for the of the committee, for the record, my name is Courtney Johnston, and I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which represents organizations that work with 8 of the 16 CCOs in Oregon. And I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 4107. Just to refresh your memory a little bit, in the spring of 2015, the Oregon Health Authority redeveloped the CCOs' reimbursement rates, and by late August, we were informed that those rates would be retroactive to January 1st, 2015. And as you heard a lot about in the September legislative days over the interim, this was a difficult proposition for businesses who budgeted and set expenditures for the year based on an understanding that that money would be there. Suddenly, several CCOs, through no fault of their own, were being required to pay back millions of dollars that they had budgeted for. And this is especially precarious, as you heard from the representative before me, that when we are talking about the health care delivery system for our state's most vulnerable citizens. Some questions were raised about the legality of this move and whether they had statutory or contractual authority to do such a thing. And so when the CCOs received their 2016 contract amendments in November, there was a new provision that gave that effectively allowed the Oregon Health Authority to make retroactive payment adjustments to at any time throughout the year. And when you heard from the Oregon Health Authority over the interim, you heard about these new processes they're putting in place to make sure that they get this right in the future. And as the state representative from the 26 informed you, this body had passed a bill last session that required 60 days notice. So we have that information a lot sooner. There's a lot of good processes in place now to make sure that we don't have this problem in the future. And we really appreciated that message that was given through all of the work that they've done this last interim. However, this uncertainty still remains if it's in the contract as they wrote it in the 2016 amendment. And it really particularly affects a lot of the important programs that are providing real care in our communities, especially felt through our community partners that we collaborate with. When we're trying to make budget decisions and we aren't sure and we don't have the certainty that that money is going to be there, and I heard a couple examples from some of my CCOs. Just one of particular example of Western Oregon Advanced Health's ability to follow through with community partners and make investments in substance abuse and day treatment and supported housing that they're trying to make. When they don't know that money isn't going to be retroactively recouped at any time, that makes that very difficult. So this bill before you, as he said, is very simple. It removes this new contract provision, and it does allow for a provision that has always been in their contracts for if CMS, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, requires something to be, the overpayment has been made or requires money to be recouped. That's still available or allowed through this bill, but the bill does remove that provision to allow for retroactive recoupment of payments by the OHA. That they had put in the 2016 contracts.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll close.
Ms. Rayburn.
Thank you. Chair Greenlich, Vice Chair Noce, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heather Rayburn. I'm the Government Relations Manager for Family Care, and I want to thank you for the opportunity this afternoon to submit testimony in favor of House Bill 4107. We feel that House Bill 4107 is essential to ensure that the coordinated care organizations are able to make the community investments that are necessary to fulfill our mission to transform health care. As Representative Davis summarized the bill, it would prevent the Oregon Health Authority from being able to make amendments retroactively affecting our payments, so they would not be able to make an amendment and then say that we owe money back to them as a result of that amendment. And as my counterpart Courtney has pointed out, the 2016 contract does include a provision which allows the Oregon Health Authority to make an amendment and make it effective retroactively and require us to repay money that has already been paid to us with no limitation on, that has to be required by a change in federal law or state law. There's no limitations on their authority to invoke that clause.
I would assume if they actually made a mistake in payment that they could get that payment back in the current contract.
I believe
somebody wrote a check and it was $100,000 wrong.
Yes, there are laws in place that would permit that, but the contract provision would allow them to say in the middle of the year, we're changing the benefits under the Oregon Health Plan. We're making that change effective retroactively, and you're going to owe us back the money we paid you to administer that benefit. That potentially could happen under the language of the provision in the contract currently, even if the benefits were part of the package at the beginning of the year, we'd been using the rates we'd been given to pay for those benefits. There's nothing in that contract provision that would prevent them from being able to do that, and that is our concern. Each year we sign an amendment to the five-year contract setting our per-member, per-month rate prospectively. We use that prospective budget to determine our expenditures for the year. As a business, we can't operate effectively if we can't count on our contract remaining in place prospectively for the year. If we possibly might have money taken back from us in the middle of the year, we can't appropriately plan our expenditures and make our investments. We think House Bill 4107 simply codifies good business and contracting practices, which will provide the necessary stability and certainty for CCOs. It'll allow us to count on our contracted rates that we agree to at the beginning of each year and allow us to appropriately plan our expenditures for the year. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nose.
Mr. Chair, if it's appropriate, I'd like to hear what the agency thinks about this bill. Is there somebody from the agency that can come up and tell us what they think?
Let's offer the agency an opportunity, but not force them to come up and do it unless they want to. How about it? I don't see anybody rushing forward.
No, someone's coming. She's not rushing.
She is.
One brave soul.
Come on.
Yeah.
Not rushing, walking slowly. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm the External Relations Director for the Oregon Health Authority. And I think that for this, the language in House Bill 4107, excuse me, it works for us. I think the only change that we would request is that my understanding is that it calls, I'm looking for the language but not finding it, it requires a demand letter from CMS. Probably the more appropriate language would be unless required by federal law, just so that we are clear that if federal law requires a recoupment, that we can move forward on it. Under whatever provisions are in place.
Do you have an amendment coming forward? Yeah?
I would be happy to make that happen, but I don't have it today.
Let's see if we can get it in time.
That'd be great.
Wednesday?
In time for Wednesday. That's a simple amendment.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Representative Kennedy.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
At least grown.
First of all, I'm glad to see this bill come forward, and I think, and I've certainly said this loudly enough and previously, but I think retroactive is a pretty reprehensible way to deal with individuals and entities in Oregon. On the other hand, I understand there are some extenuating circumstances. I think this is a good compromise, and I just would note for kind of point of information, Representative Gomberg and I have co-sponsored House Bill 4601, which raises the question and puts some sideboards on the use of emergency clauses by agencies, because I think we have a real problem here that when emergency clauses are used, there's no process for that's a value judgment, but from my perspective, no reasonable way to come to some kind of consensus or workable agreement. And instead, we end up launching huge lawsuits or people get abused or whatever happens in that process. And I think we need to figure a way to rein in this excessive use of emergency clauses and create a more friendly environment, which is the tradition here in Oregon. And that hearing will be tomorrow.
Great. Thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4107 and carry over a work session on 4107 to Wednesday. We'll wait for an amendment from OHA.
We've got two choices.
too.
You're just going to carry that.
I'm going to carry it over to Wednesday, House Bill 4141. The work session on House Bill 4141. That's a bill to deal with the question of geographic distribution of CCO. We'll see where we're going with that and with some other stuff. Are we ready for...
And don't forget your bill. You've got a public hearing.
Yeah, I know. We can hold that to the end. Why don't we do the public hearing now? We'll do a public hearing. You'll come back soon. Okay. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 4100. Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the
number sounds familiar to me.
No surprise. House Bill 4100 modifies the requirements for, yes, you guessed it, the coordinated care organizations. In 2018 and 2023, requires CCOs to be community-based nonprofit organizations, to have memberships of the governing body that reflects local control, and to distribute at least 80% of payments to providers using alternative payment methodologies. It also creates the community escrow fund and the state treasury to hold the CCO restricted reserves, requires the health policy board to adopt minimum criteria for the continuation of contracts with the CCO. You have a dash one amendment that extends all of the dates in the bill by 1 year. So anything that had a 2023 is out to 2024, is that right, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, it's the 2017 moves to 2018, 2023 moves to 2024.
And 2022 moves to 2023, and 2018 moves to 2019.
Right.
So
I'm going to talk about it from here, if I may. 4100 looks forward to the rebidding of the five-year contracts for the CCOs. It was my impression, an incorrect impression, that the contracts ran out in 2017 and would be rebid sometime that year. So I thought it was important to get this bill in for the short session because we wouldn't have time to deal with it in 2017. And now it turns out that the contracts actually run through 2018 and would be rebid again in 2018 for time period beginning 2019 and going for 5 years beyond that. That gives us enough time to think about this bill and especially to deal with the questions of what CCOs should look like downstream. I think we had the bill that started the CCOs, House Bill 3650, was an amazing job to get done. We had a 30-30 legislature, and we produced a bill that got something like 53 positive votes in the House to pass. That meant we made a lot of compromises, and I think it would be a good time to see how those compromises have worked, to see whether we've structured things in the right way or whether they ought to be structured differently. This bill formulates 8 new procedures for the redoing of the CCO contracts. My intention is to have a relatively brief hearing on this bill today, to bring it back for a more intense hearing later in the month when we finish our formal work and give people a chance to really opine about this bill, and then take it into the interim to bring folks together to try and create a bill that, while we might not get consensus on, we can comfortably get 31-16-1 on, which is the basic rule, without too many people screaming about how awful it was while we did that. So I live a rich fantasy life, and therefore I have high hopes that we can actually come to some agreement over the next year before we get into the 2017 session. So I'm going to end my remarks there and call a brief panel. folks who have asked to comment on this, and we have Jonathan Ames and Martin Taylor. If anybody else wants, we have a few minutes. If anybody else wants to join the party, if not, we'll have a public hearing toward the end of the month, and invite lots of people to come in and talk about what's on their mind. Mr. Ames, you want to start? Mr. Taylor, you can have the long form.
Okay. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of HealthShare of Oregon. So thank you very much, Representative Greenlick, for bringing this bill forward. HealthShare believes that this is the critical time to start having this conversation. As contracts do come up for renewal, the fact that the legislature is willing to be forward-looking and not just take what has been as what we're going to move forward, or at least have the conversation with the various 16 CCOs and maybe others that are interested in this market as well, and how best the state can respond and look towards the future and make our contracts a better reflection of what we want as far as our needs and our individual communities for health care in the state. So your bill, which really is provocative in a way and challenges us to think differently than what we have seen, which may or may not end up in the final iteration of the bill, but it gives us the opportunity as CCOs to think about what transformation means and what transformation could be. Can we do things differently to either meet the triple aim or meet the quadruple aim or whatever it is, or really deliver better health care to the people of our state? So thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation. Realize that we are moving it forward a little bit because of the different times in the contracts, but we look forward to working with you and the various committee members into the future to make a good bill next legislative session.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here representing CARE Oregon and the CCOs affiliated with CARE Oregon in Jackson County and in the Columbia Pacific CCO region. So I understand there'll be an opportunity to opine at length another time, so I will keep my remarks a little shorter, but I do want to start with a reminder of how we got to CCOs, because this legislation represents something that could be as bold as CCOs 2.0. We started before we had an ACA, but for the same reasons that the federal government was looking at broad health care reform. We had too many people who did not have health insurance and a health insurance system that was very fragmented. We had some legislators in this process that wanted to look at something like a public option or universal access. So we were aspirational. We had this sort of high-level thought of what might be possible in Oregon. And we went through a very elaborate process to come up with CCOs. It was first a commission chaired by Bates and Westland, followed by Senate Bill 326 that formed the Oregon Health Fund Board that resulted in a proposal that came out of this legislature's 2009 and was followed up by work groups and then Wednesday night meetings that eventually got us to 3650. That was 3 or 4 years of work. It's unlikely that
we're going to get Monday night meetings.
Monday night meetings. It's not likely to cover that amount of breadth in one bill in a small session. So I absolutely appreciate the intent of this bill and where it's headed, but recognize that it's probably wise to use the interim for that process. But the most important thing that happened in there is that we recognized as a state that we controlled 40% of the health care dollars, and that if we were a smart purchaser, we could drive system change simply by how we bought health care. That smart purchaser strategy is a critical strategy, but it's not one that you get right the first time you put it out there. CCOs have been tremendous in terms of reflecting your values of a global budget, greater transparency, more local control of boards. We've absolutely started moving towards quality through the pay-for-performance measures. We've done a lot of things right, but it was our first step. It was our first shot at it. So I think it's completely fair for you as legislators to say every 5 years, we're going to look at the CCO model, and we're going to say, what do we improve? What do we tinker with? How do we make this better? In fact, if you don't do that, I think it's negligence. I think that it's your obligation to the people who receive the health care in the communities that we work to try to make the model better every 5 years.
What this legislation does is very interesting because it sits in this very legislative session in contrast with two other approaches. There's legislation on the Senate side, and that approach is to say, we're going to have evergreen contracts for CCOs, where if you meet minimum standards, you're guaranteed of your work. That essentially is an entitlement. It says CCOs are entitled to their work as long as they meet minimum standards. On the other extreme, you have a process that if you do nothing, essentially allows the OHA to say, well, we could just put this all out to bid. Every 5 years, we're going to open it wide open and see who wants to come into each of these regions and offer us the best value. Now, I understand as a set of legislators, you may say, hey, we want every 5 years to have a chance to have a competitive bidding process and to see who offers the most value. What I like about this bill you've introduced, Representative, is it cuts a middle path. It essentially says we're going to raise the bar every 5 years, but if you meet that higher bar, we're not going to put you out to bid. I think that's a fair standard. Care Oregon does not expect you to lower the bar for us. And we don't expect to just meet minimum standards. We expect you to expect more of us every time. That's our contract with you. It's our contract with the folks who we provide care for. You ought to expect us to get better. I like a bill that expects us to get better. We welcome that challenge. So to me, where this ends up may not look exactly like the sections of the bill that you've got now, and Care Oregon has some specific suggestions of amendments and tweaks, but it's the right direction to go. And so we'll opine at greater length about the particulars of the bill another day.
And I'll explicate the eight areas when we do it that time.
Is there any questions of these witnesses?
Representative Buehler?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. Open question to either one. What, if you could, what are the three major problems we need to solve with regards to CCO's version 1.0?
Well, so I will take a stab at that. I think the first thing is the CCO template really has six attributes as listed on the Oregon Health Authority's website. I would look at those six attributes and say, how well are CCOs measuring up to those standards? The things that we are still weakest on, to be honest, are really using alternative payment methods so that our providers and the CCO share risk. That varies from CCO to CCO. But when you have the provider and the CCOs both sharing some risk, you have your greatest ability to bend the cost curve, and you essentially are in a partnership with your provider network to improve quality. That's been difficult because, frankly, there's been enough money in CCOs that we haven't had to drive new alternative payment methods in order to survive. In other words, you could fall back on when you have a surplus in your CCO, you could simply pay more to the provider rather than force system change. I think there's still some transparency issues. CCOs, many of them have a governance process where there's an ownership model and one entity essentially has a majority of the seats and holds all of the profits. So in all the CCOs, there could be more transparency, but certainly in those CCOs where you essentially have an ownership model, there's a big difference between the owners and the rest of the community that have the minority seats on a board. And if I was to pick one other, to be honest, I don't understand why CCOs are for-profit entities, particularly not when there's so much profit in CCOs. These are tax dollars. People are not giving those tax dollars to us for us to make money. They're giving those tax dollars to us with the intention of helping low-income people get out of poverty. So just to get a sense of scale, in 2014 you had about a $13 billion budget and maybe assisted $300 million of surplus. Well, that's not a bad rate of surplus at a $13 billion, but the $300 million doesn't all get back into the community. A lot of that went back into people making a lot of personal wealth. If that was your school system, you wouldn't want your superintendents making personal wealth. If it was a correction system, you wouldn't want your, you know, heads of your prisons making that wealth. Only in Medicaid is it sort of seen okay when there's a surplus to put that money back into individual wealth. I think that's not consistent with what a publicly funded program should look like.
But the challenge I've got with that philosophy is in the school district, unlike the LLC that owns the one here, that superintendent would never lose personal wealth either if it went in the hole on the global budget. The owners of this would, out of their own pockets, if I understand our structure right, they have a risk sharing and they'll lose money.
So if you have a for-profit entity, then you have to have it swing both ways.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree. In the care working model, in the model of half the CCOs, there wouldn't be personal, like the superintendent wouldn't lose money personally. We wouldn't lose money personally either.
Yeah.
So it really is just structurally, what do you want the CCO to look like? Do you want it to look more like a public entity or a not-for-profit entity where the community really runs that program and the community takes the risk, or do you want that risk held by individuals for both reward or downside risk?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler and Representative Clem, I think, and I don't know if this is the biggest problem, but I think it's the biggest challenge before us, is when we look at CCOs and what we have intended them to be or not, but where they came out as community-based, community-focused entities that, you know, are Oregon-born, Oregon-bred, and I think some of the challenges that I hear right now in the community is that a model that we want to continue? Is it something that as we do deliver healthcare, is that local model, that local community model, something we want to move forward with? You know, there are people on both sides of that question. You know, do we want other outside entities to come into Oregon and deliver the care or buy CCOs? Are these something that should be traded as like a public company or anything like that? That's the question I think people, and it goes to Martin's, Mr. Taylor's point too, as far as structurally, how are we going to create these? Is this something that should be, profit driven, or that should have assets that are easier to obtain? I think that's one of the fundamental questions we're going to try to answer, I think, with Representative Greenlee's
bill. In the crafting of the CCO bill, to begin with, there were really two schools of thought about what a CCO should be. One school of thought was they should be the medical care organizations, the MCOs that had served the poverty, sort of MCO on steroids was the way we referred to it. The other model was it was supposed to be a community-based nonprofit organization that worked more like a school district. And we didn't come to a conclusion on that. We left both of those options available because the political reality of it is we needed to get this bill because it meant a $1.9 billion windfall from the federal government that allowed us to balance the budget. So we acted very pragmatically. We said, okay, we'll let every flower grow and see how it works. Some of those flowers turned into beautiful rose gardens, and some of them turned into kind of weedy patches that serve what functions it serves. But it feels to me like it's time for us to try that one more time and say, is this what we want? And the way that I've crafted the bill, it's not that it would cause anybody to change overnight, but it would say when you apply for this five-year contract, here's what we want things to look like 5 years from now. Talk about how you see us moving from 2019 to 2024 on the way to getting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a long-term look at this, and I think it should be interesting to give the legislature an opportunity to get into it. I've also made an informal request, and I'll make a formal request to get the Health Policy Board to take a look at this. It seems to me that's the sort of thing they make sense to do. They have the responsibility for crafting health policy in the state, and I thought it'd be really good to get a deliberative body working at the same time we're working. If there are no other comments, we'll have.
Representative
Buehler
just asked another question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Chair Greenlee, maybe you're most appropriate to answer this, but is the proposal still to change the membership of the governing body of CCOs at this point?
The proposal that's in front of us, 4100, has that. It has the creating a government body that's more dominated by community members and by either the providers or the risk-bearing institutions to balance that board. Of course, everything is up for grabs.
Okay. So
these are a particular set of solutions to what I see are the problems, but other people will have different disagreement on whether there's a problem or not, and disagreement on the solutions when they believe there is a problem.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4100. If you don't mind, I would like to open a work session on 4100 for the purpose of adopting the Dash 1 amendments, which does nothing but move all the dates forward so they're consistent with the reality. Let's hear a motion.
All right, then. Mr. Chair, I would like to move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 4100 dated January 29, 2016.
Representative Nose moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 4100 dated 1-29-16. Is there any objection? So moved. Close the work session on House Bill 4100. Not carry it over. That's right. I don't need to carry it over. No, I want to hear it after we're done with our work.
Okay.
Yeah, no. We need Wednesday for whatever we need to clean things up. Okay, we have two work sessions now, I think. Is that right?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
We have 4017. All right.
Mr. Chair, we heard 47, well, pardon me.
Oh, go for it.
Well, I'm disorganized, like you said. House Bill 4017 had a work session on public hearing and a work session on Friday. You'll recall this requires Department of Consumer and Business Services in collaboration with the Oregon Health Authority and Stakeholder Advisory Group to create a blueprint for the basic health program. Specifies the requirement for the basic health program, grants sole authority to the department to submit a waiver for state innovation under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, requires the department to report to the legislative committees and legislative assembly on the BHP or basic health program blueprint and recommendations for the waiver for state innovation, declares an emergency effective on passage. We heard from Ozzie Rose on the Dash 4 amendments, which was a technical fix to a bill that we passed regarding school nurses and their status of employment. Then the Dash 5 amendment was the stakeholder amendment that is before us for consideration. The Dash 5 directs DCBS, the health authority, and the stakeholder group to develop the blueprint and the recommendation, and also specifies criteria. What we now have before us that we did not have on Friday is a Dash 7 amendment, and that was at the request of Representative Hayden.
Well, the Dash 7 amendment has five words or something and takes out the part that says it should be designed without an adult dental program and leaves that as an open question, right?
Correct.
Correct.
Is that your...
Can you say that again, please?
Yeah, the bill says that it should create a basic health plan excluding adult dental.
Exactly.
His amendment takes out the exclusion of adult dental and leaves that as an open question.
Right. That's the only thing it does.
Right. The Dash 7. Right.
The least four words or something. I do want to point out there are two different components to this bill. One component is DCBS directed to create the blueprint for the basic health plan. The other component is about 1332 waivers and gives DCBS the responsibility for coordinating all 1332 waivers that come from state agencies. We raised the question in the first one, does DCBS have the authority when they've given us the blueprint for the basic health plan to go ahead and apply to the federal government for implementing that blueprint? We asked the legal counsel, and alleged counsel says absolutely not, that DCBS, that it's only instruction to forward it to us. It does not give them the authority to move it forward without our action. And the other part of the bill, the 1332 waivers, they do have the ability to distribute them if they have, I mean, to send it in to apply if they have that ability under current statute. So.
And just for the committee's reference, we do have that memo on OLIS that Lori Freeman sent to the chair. Outlining the options and the distinction between the two, legislative authority for the blueprint and the position on the 1332 waiver.
Could you please summarize the 1332 waiver again? They may not seek the waiver without our...
The 1332 waivers?
Yes.
No, they may if they have the authority to do it now. This doesn't change their authority. It simply names DCBS as the coordinating agency for submitting 1332 waivers. That's all it does. We don't have all the paperwork, but it would be probably useful to adopt the amendments.
Mr. Chair, we do have a fiscal and a revenue on the dash fives and the dash fours. We do not have anything on the dash seven. Just for the record, I do anticipate that this bill, well, I don't anticipate, the bill needs to have a referral to Ways and Means added when we get ready to move the bill out of committee. But it, if the committee so chooses, the amendments are available for consideration.
I would say let's put the amendments in and then get all the paperwork ready that we need to send it to Ways and Means on Wednesday. Wednesday's our last day.
Oh, correct.
How about some motions?
How about some? All right, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 4017, dated February 4th, 2016.
Let's move them in mass.
Okay, and then I also want to move the Dash 5, dated February 3rd, 2016. And I'll go ahead for good measure and move the Dash 7, which is for House Bill 4017, dated February 8th, 2016.
Representative Nose moves, I open a work session on House Bill 4017. Representative Nose moves the Dash 4 amendments dated 2-4-16, the Dash 5 amendments dated 2-3-16, and the Dash 7 amendments dated 2-8-16 to House Bill 4017. Is there any discussion on the amendments?
No discussion.
Any opposition? So moved. Close the work session on House Bill 4017 and carry the work session over until Wednesday.
Correct.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4124. What do we have, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, recall we heard House Bill 4124 on February 3rd. This requires the Oregon Health Authority to disclose the prescription monitoring information to practitioner or pharmacist or member of practitioners or pharmacist staff for use in certain health information technology systems. This has a dash one amendment. It requires OHA to periodically check the compliance of the privacy and security standards to include HIPAA compliance, clarifies the pharmacist prescribing authority to be adopted by the State Board of Pharmacy. What we also have that came in today are the Dash 4 amendments. And the Dash 4 amendments, hold on 1 second.
Where did it come from?
They come from Rep. Bueller at the request of Multnomah County.
I can help you with that.
And sure, or Jordan gave me a great one too. Basically, the Dash 4 amendment allow employees who have gone through the training to administer naloxone to someone experiencing an overdose, even if they are not a patron or on the premises of that specific organization.
Okay, yeah. That allows somebody to come outside of a clinic and
outside on the street.
Right. Somebody laying out on the street in front of the clinic.
So they don't have to be a patron. They can be an individual.
Right. But they have to be trained.
Yes.
So you have the Dash 4 dated today and the Dash 1 from last week, and I believe it's...
Put the Dash 1 in already?
No, Mr. Chair, we have not taken any action on this bill, other than the public hearing.
Well, let's have a motion on the two of them.
Can I do them both at the same time?
Yep.
All right. Mr. Chair, I would like to move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 4124, dated February 1st, 2016. And I would like to move the Dash 4 to House Bill 4124, dated February 8th, 2016.
Okay.
And just for the record, we do have a fiscal impact on the Dash 1. This also will need to have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Oh, because of the fiscal?
Yes.
How much is the fiscal?
$150,000.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That's been modified.
I thought we were working on that.
We have been working on it, and it's been reduced to, I think, $98,000.
Oh, I apologize. We did get a revise. It's down to $99,700.
There you go.
There we go.
Still needs to go, but that's better.
We're working on it.
Okay, I'm sorry. Picked up the wrong one.
Did we move the amendments?
Yes, you just did.
Now you need to.
Is there any discussion on the amendments? Is there any objection to the amendments? So moved. I'll close the work session on House Bill 4124 and carry it over to a work session on Wednesday. We'll hopefully have the paperwork and the referral. Could we review what's moving forward to Wednesday?
I would love to review that, Mr. Chair. Okay.
House Bill 4107 had a public hearing today. The work session got carried over to Wednesday, 2:10. The amendments were adopted to House Bill 4017 today. The work session will be carried over to Wednesday, 2:10. 4030, the dash 1 and dash 2s were adopted today. Work session carried over to 2:10. House Bill 4124, we adopted the 1s and the 4s today, carried over the work session to Wednesday, 2:10. House Bill 4141, work session carried over to Wednesday.
Did we have a work session scheduled on Wednesday already?
No, the Wednesday agenda is just there to be filled with what we carried over from today.
I don't think Wednesday will take us too long, but it would be really helpful if you could be here on time. I know, I understand there are hearings and all sorts of things going on. We're not the only committee facing this, so do the best you can, but I think we'll be able to handle them mostly pretty quickly.
Committee members, did your notes match up with my notes? Or okay. Thank you.
Try it to.
All right. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.
Good night, Brian. Good night, Brian.